Our speaker tonight is Dr. Lynn Johnson. And Lynn is one of the most knowledgeable people about near-death experiences that I know of. And he has some fabulous experiences to share. But even more than that, one of the great things about Lynn is that he has some wonderful insights about what those experiences mean and how we can learn from them. I've always thought to myself, this is really cool that I can learn a lot about near-death experiences without actually having to go through one. And Lynn is one of the people that assists in that wonderful endeavor. Please give our speaker, Lynn Johnson, a warm round of applause.
Thank you. It was about 1984. My grandfather lived in St. George, where I grew up. And one day I decided when I was home visiting, I would go over and visit him, and I would take my tape recorder. I interviewed him for 90 minutes. We had a lovely conversation about his life. I said, "Tell me about your life, Grandpa." And he said, "Well, there's not much to tell. I don't remember much. Remember, when I went to first grade, Armin Roundy was very nice to me. I really appreciate it because we had just moved to town and I didn't know anybody in town. And I remember my first grade teacher was so-and-so," and he went on through this. He had a lot of interesting experiences in his life. He just held me spellbound to the end. My grandmother had died about 10 years earlier, and Grandpa finally remarried, and he married a woman we called Aunt Myrtle. Myrtle said, "Well, tell him about that experience up at Kennicott." "Oh, I don't know if he'd be interested in that." "Well, Grandpa, I'm interested in everything about your life." He said, "Well," said, "as a result of my father dying when I was in eighth grade, I had to take over the ranch. But by the time I was 19, I could see that the younger kids could run the ranch, and so I went to Salt Lake and I got a job, what is now the Kennicott operation." He's very lonely. He'd never been outside of the little town of Tropic where he grew up. And one day he said he was sitting, eating his lunch, and he was talking with a coworker, and he was talking about spiritual things. And the coworker got up and left, and he was resting against a big beam. And he suddenly said, "My spirit came right up out of my body." He said, "Oh, the freedom I felt. I could just go anywhere just by thinking about where I wanted to go. I didn't see anybody else. I didn't see any other spirits. I just felt so free, and I traveled through the air with not an effort in the world." And suddenly he said, "A strange thought struck me. I left my jacket back there." And he said, he went back to where his body was still lying against that beam, and he reached down to get his jacket, and he says, "As soon as I touched my jacket, something grabbed me, and I was back in my body." He said, "Never fear death. It is the most wonderful thing you can imagine." I was absolutely struck by that. My goodness, my goodness, my goodness. That was at the very end of the tape. I got home. Dad had picked a bushel of apricots off the apricot tree, and he was starting to bottle them. So I washed up, and we bottled apricots. I said, "You ought to listen to this interview I just did with Grandpa." So I turned on the tape, and he listened to it, and we worked for about an hour and a half bottling apricots, which is the easiest fruit in the world to bottle, because you just split them, take out the pit, and shove them in the quart jar, and then you throw a little sugar and some water on, and you're done. And they're delicious. They make the best syrup in the world for pancakes, far better than maple syrup. Maple syrup is a pale imitation. It's a joke compared to apricot syrup. And all you have to do is put a little more sugar in it, boil it for a minute, and whip it up in a blender, and you've got the most wonderful waffle and pancake syrup. And we're doing this, and we get to the end, and Dad is listening to this story. Suddenly, he dries his hands off. He goes over and calls my uncle. "Sheldon," he says, "you ought to come down here and listen to this. Lynn has made a tape of Dad's life. There are things on here I've never heard before." And I thought, what? Grandpa didn't tell anybody about this? I guess he told Aunt Myrtle. but he didn't tell anybody else. He had a variety of powerful spiritual experiences. He was very tuned in. He wanted to remarry, and so he made it a topic of his prayers. And he said, one day he was standing next to this woman, and an audible voice came to him in his ear and said, "This is the one." My grandfather said, "Thank you, I'll take it from here." Not long after that, I read an article in Omni magazine, sort of a semi-scientific magazine, about near-death experiences. I was struck by the fact that there were these people making various predictions about the future as a result of their near-death experience. I thought this would be an interesting thing to study. I made a decision that I would study near-death experiences. Within a week of making a decision, a new patient who had been in a terrible, terrible truck wreck and was recovering suddenly told me about a near-death experience he had had. He was in the sleeper cab. They were hauling a load of steel going up I-80 from Reno. It had been snowing. They slid off the highway. The load of steel rolled over him, breaking pretty much every bone in his body. And he laid there and he felt himself dying. He said it was like all of his energies just started concentrating right here around the heart, and he felt he was just about ready to leave his body. He said, "Now look, I'd tried about everything. I'd tried drugs. I'd tried all kinds of things. I am telling you, dying is the most fun you will ever have." He was in the hospital there in Reno for several months because all of his bones were broken. And it turned out that his nurse was giving injections of water, and then she'd take the Demerol home and shoot it up herself. And so he had a lot of pain. And I thought, wait a minute. Something's going on here. As soon as I decided to study this, a door opened. Somebody walked through. I started having patients tell me spiritual things that in the 10 years of my practice before that, no one had ever mentioned. I've been in practice since 1977. I am retired. You can't see me anymore unless you're an old patient, and even then I give you a hard time. Say, "No, you don't want to come see me. I'm old. I'm probably getting dementia. You don't want to mess with me. I'm an old geezer now." Somebody asked me the other day, "Well, how old are you?" "I'm 70. "You're looking pretty good at 70. "Yeah, if you'll meditate throughout your life, that'll do that for you. It'll slow the process of aging down a lot. I'm planning on living to 100. I think I can do that. I'm in pretty good health. I run every day or so. I'm up to 45 push-ups. I did 45 push-ups this morning. I'm going to try to get up to 100. I've never been able to do more than about 30. So my wife said, "You're 70. You can't gain muscle." "No, I can too. And I've gone from about 25 where I started up to 45 this morning." Around the time that this young man told me his near-death experience, out of the blue, Ted Packard at the University of Utah called me up, one of my old professors. "Well, Ted, how are you?" He said, "You know, I've got some money left over from a grant, an NIMH grant. Can you think of anything we should research?" "As a matter of fact," I said. And so we put out advertisements. We went out and we started interviewing people who had had near-death experiences. One of the near-death experiences was a woman named Patricia. And to help later on when we started getting this group together, Patricia and I went on some TV shows and we would be interviewed. I'd be the shrink. "I have a doctor's degree. You can trust me, you know." That's a line from Airplane. "I'm a doctor. You can tell me." He says, "How long will it be before we get to the airport?" "I can't say. I'm a doctor. You can tell me." And so I would provide the legitimacy. And then Patricia would tell her story. Her story was a very interesting one. At 17, she realized her mother had two modes of being schizophrenic and drunk. When she was schizophrenic, she was almost impossible to relate to. When she was drunk, she was almost impossible to relate to. Patricia started spiraling down into a very deep depression. She was horribly lonely. She found some deadly-looking stuff in her brother's chemistry set, went in the bathroom, locked the door, swallowed the stuff, and lay down and got ready to die. Well, the stuff was somewhat corrosive. She started going into convulsions. She was thrashing around. Her mother, her brother, heard her in the bathroom. They broke down the door. They rushed her to the hospital. There's a law called EMTALA. It was passed in about 1980. Basically, what it does is it makes emergency room physicians slaves. Anybody can go to an emergency room and get care. They can't turn you away. Before that, they could turn you away. And the mother rushes her to the hospital, and they say, "You have no insurance. We don't want to take your daughter as a patient. You have no insurance." They admitted her. Patricia was unconscious during this time. Suddenly she found herself floating in the air. She was looking down at a gurney. On the gurney was a figure. Next to the gurney were two men. She could feel their emotions. "If I touch you, you can feel my touch." She could feel their emotions directly. And one was very cold and angry, and the other was very concerned and frightened. The angry man said to the other, "Go tell that woman that her daughter just died." And the more frightened, concerned one said, "Shouldn't you do that?" The other said, "Look, if you're going to be a doctor, you have to give people bad news. It's part of our job." Second one said, "Isn't there anything else we could do?" At that point, Patricia became aware of two individuals, two beings in the air next to her. And they said to her, "Patricia, are you ready to die?" She said, "Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes." "Patricia, we don't want you to die now. You were sent to Earth to learn something. And if you don't learn it in this way, you'll have to learn it in another way that's more painful. Patricia is 17. Have any of you raised children, and have they survived 17? You know what she's going to say. "I don't care." And she said, "Nobody loves me." The entity said, "Well, your mother does love you, but she's very, very ill, and she can't show it." And then they showed her a vision of the mother bargaining with the ER, the admissions people. "Look," she said, "I work as a janitor at night in this very hospital. You can have everything I earn for the rest of my life if you can save my daughter." They said, "You work here at night?" "Yes." "Yeah, we better take her." So they brought her in. Patricia thought, "Well, that puts a new light on it. My mother does love me. She's either drunk or crazy, and in neither of those conditions do people show love, but nevertheless, the love is there," and she went back into her body. When I met Patricia, she was a very, very successful executive assistant. She made a very fine living. She had created a very good life for herself, one that you would not have predicted if you had known that she came from a mother with schizophrenia, alcoholism, and existing on the very, very fringes of society. One day I said, "Patricia," they said, "if you don't learn it this way, you'll have to learn it in another that's more painful." What do they mean? This tells you something about Patricia. It tells you something about integrity. She said, "I don't know. They didn't explain it." She said, "Maybe you go to hell and you learn it there. Maybe you get reincarnated into an even worse life. I think it's probably reincarnation. But I just don't know. I haven't any idea how you'd learn something if you didn't learn it here." I appreciated her because she was really very clear on what she had experienced and what she just was making up, speculating about. Oh, I just appreciated that so much. We had a wonderful talk one day, Martin and Arvin Gibson. His books are still out. He's gone, but his books are still in this world. And so you can look up Arvin's books and you'll read about some of the people that you might have heard in this near-death support group. Martin and Arvin and I had been thinking, these people need a support group. Remember, my grandfather didn't tell anybody about it. I remembered a woman that I interviewed, and she said, 20 years, she thought, I'm the only one who knows. I'm the only one who knows. She would talk to priests and ministers, and she'd just sort of turn away from them because she'd say, you don't know. I know what it's like. So they had no answers for her. It broke my heart to think of her loneliness, her isolation. And I thought, people need a place where they can speak. There was a cardiologist giving a presentation about his experiences dealing with people who had resuscitated. Cardiologists resuscitate people. And he had interviewed them, and some of them had these incredible near-death experiences. And in the audience, a doctor spoke up. He said, wait a minute. I've been a cardiologist for 30 years. I've never heard one person tell me about this. How do you explain that, doctor? And another doctor in the same audience stood up and said, I'm a patient of that man over there. I had a near-death experience. I'll be damned if I'm going to tell him about it. You see, it's not always safe to tell people things they don't want to hear about. A friend of mine teaches at NYU, says, when facts and opinion collide, we throw facts under the bus. We'll hang on to our opinions. When I was a carpenter, we had a saying, some people have 10 years of experience as a carpenter. Other people have 1 year of experience 10 times in a row. What I want to challenge you, when you come to these near-death support groups, come with an open mind. We don't know anything. The greatest movie ever made is called Joe Versus the Volcano. You thought it was something like that stupid movie about the sled named Rosebud. No, it's not that at all. It's a dumb movie. It's Joe Versus the Volcano. Joe has 6 months to live. A man hires him to jump into a volcano. If he jumps into a volcano, the natives on the island where the volcano is will let him mine a very, very rare mineral that's on the island, and then he can make superconductors out of that. Joe meets the daughter of this man. They fall in love. She says, you can't jump now. He said, I got to do this. All my life I've been running away. I have to do this. And she follows him as they walk up the mountain. He gets to the edge. She says, Joe, I love you. He says, I love you. It's great. I've never been in love before, but the timing stinks. And she turns to the chief and says, Chief, marry us. Joe says, marry you? What's the matter? Are you afraid of having to love, honor, and obey me for 30 seconds? He says, all right, let's marry. And so they get married. They walk out to jump into the volcano, and Patricia says to Joe, Joe, nobody knows anything. We'll jump and we'll see. They jump, but actually a big gust of volcanic gases blows them out of the volcano and they land in the ocean. Then the whole island sinks and then some other wonderful things happen. Now, when you come to these, I think you have to take this attitude of nobody knows anything. People have lots and lots of opinions and they have very few facts to go on. What have I learned from studying near-death experiences since 1985? One is that they're amazingly common. I was just talking to my dear friend here who gave a fireside on near-death experiences, and Martin said that a woman came up to him and told him an amazing near-death experience. Now, that is just as common as can be. You give a talk to a group of 30 people, one or two or three of those are going to tell a near-death experience. But they don't talk about it all the time. Grandpa never talked about his out-of-body experience. This woman that had gone 25 years thinking she was the only one until I told her about our support group, she had never told anyone. If you want to learn more about this, you kind of open your heart, and you open your mind, and something will come. There's lots of books out now on it. People have, in my lifetime, the whole attitude about this has changed dramatically. What can we learn from the near-death experiences? One is that spiritual factors are powerful, they're present, and it's only because we're half blind and deaf that we don't see them. In the movie Joe versus the Volcano, Patricia Grainmore says, "My father," this is the man that hired Joe to jump into the volcano, "my father says that almost nobody in the world is awake. Everybody's asleep. Everyone you see, everyone you know, everyone you talk to. He says only a few people are awake, and they live their lives in a state of constant, total amazement." So one of the things that we learn from the near-death experience is this is an amazing life. And a woman had had a near-death experience. She was supposed to have a laparoscopy, a really minor surgical procedure, in and out, and suddenly she found herself in a splendid room, and the walls were made of light and knowledge. Now, this was before the internet, but she said she felt if she wanted to know anything, all she had to do is sort of plug into the walls of the room, and she could learn anything she wanted. A man came to her and said, "You have to go back. You've come early. You're not supposed to be here now." She says, "No, I don't think so. I like it here. I feel better now than I ever remember feeling." And he said, "Your husband can't do a good job of raising your children." She said, "Children. Yes, that's right. I have children, don't I?" Forgot about them. So she agreed to go back, and he said, "Look, I'm going to send you back, but there are two things I want you to remember. Don't forget these." Suddenly, she's in the hospital. She wakes up and she said, "Is the surgery over?" And they said, "No, we couldn't do it. As soon as we gave you the anesthetic, your heart stopped, and we have to keep you in the hospital overnight to make sure it doesn't stop again." "What? No, my mother is senile. If I don't get home in a couple of hours, she'll burn the house down. My husband's in Denver. I can't do that. I can't stay. You have to stay." So the rest of the afternoon, she's madly on the phone trying to have somebody go over and keep her mother from burning down the house, or catch the kids as they come home from school and try to contact her husband in Denver and see if he can get home on an earlier flight. The next morning, she wakes up and she remembers her near-death experience. And she said, "The two things he told me not to forget, I've forgotten." So I said, "Well, you know, let's try some hypnosis." And so I hypnotized her, and she was able to remember both of them. And so here are the messages that she got. Number one, you believe something that's very false. You think that God tolerates you but doesn't really love you, and I want you to know that's totally false. God loves you very, very much. That made her feel very good because she felt so unworthy. And the other thing he said is, "Look, the world was made for your enjoyment, and you're not enjoying it. That's wrong. The world is there for you to enjoy." Now, we have beautiful mountains to the east. We have beautiful mountains to the west. We have spectacular sunrises. We have spectacular sunsets. We have wonderful weather right now. You can roll down your windows and drive around. Why not enjoy the world? That's why we are living on this world, is to enjoy it. I'm old enough now that I have grandchildren, and it makes me feel wonderful to see my children and my grandchildren enjoy themselves and do fun things and have good experiences. Don't you think God has the same attitude about each and every one of you? One of the things that I learned from our near-death support group was from a guy named Don Woods. How many of you remember or have known of Don Woods' experience? Anybody? A few. Okay. So I'm going to tell you something about Don Woods. Don Woods had cystic fibrosis. He had been in the hospital for some kind of a roto-rooter operation on his nose and his sinuses, trying to get it so he could breathe more easily. And suddenly he woke up, it was 2:00 in the morning, and he was outside of his body. And he thought, "Hey, not bad. I made it to 32. 32 is more than most cystic fibrosis people live. This is fine. This is great." And he said there was a tunnel and there was a light, and he thought, "Oh yeah, there's that light I've read about." And he went over and he started poking his hand through this wall of the tunnel. "So what's this thing made of anyway?" "Don. Don. Donald. What? Donald, come up here." He zips up to the light and he said, "My Heavenly Father was behind that light. I knew it." I said, "How did you know?" "I remembered his voice. I could remember his voice. I know who that is." And the voice invites him to go into the light, saying, "Come and be with me now, Donald, and know more happiness than you could have possibly thought was available." He says, "Why am I worthy of that? what did I ever do? And he's told, because of the pain you suffered, you learned as much in 32 years as most of my children learn in 82 years. Don says, now wait a minute. Why did I have to suffer all that pain? Because cystic fibrosis is a painful disease. He's told, you chose the pain you'd suffer and the means by which you'd suffer it. And then Donald says something like, you're kidding. And in this case, God was not kidding, because he then showed Don a vision. And in the vision, Don is in a group of people, and there's a man in front of them saying, okay, these are the things you can expect to learn if you go to Earth and take on a physical body. And he's explaining these things. And he said, now there are two ways to learn on Earth, fast and slow. The fast way involves a lot of pain. For example, cystic fibrosis. And Don said he wrote the word cystic fibrosis in front of them. So one day I said, all right, Don, what language was it in? And he laughed. He said, well, that shows what a fool you are. And I said, well, there's no doubt I'm a fool. In what way am I a fool here? And he said, it's a vision given to me for my understanding. And so it's in English, so I would be able to read it. But that doesn't mean that that's what language it was in or anything else. It's just, it's just an educational vision. Cystic fibrosis. The man said, people who choose this disease have a lot of pain, and that means they learn a lot faster than people who don't choose any diseases. Do I have any volunteers in this group for that disease? Don said, suddenly he remembered what was in his heart, which was, now wait a minute, be careful, you don't know what pain is, you don't know what you're getting into here. But he said, fast learning, that sounds good to me, and he raised his hand and volunteered. He had a good sense of humor. He used to tell people, if you go into your body backwards, then you're left-handed. And then that means... people say, really? And he say, no, of course not. Don't be silly. I talked to him a little bit before he died, and he had been able to have several meaningful years. Cassandra Musgraves came down from Oregon. When you see that little can and we put money in it, when we have a really good speaker and they have to fly in, then we buy their airline ticket. Cassandra Musgraves came down from Oregon, told a very interesting story. She'd had an extremely difficult, painful relationship with her mother. In that near-death experience, she suddenly saw that she and her mother had agreed on that experience so that she could learn at a faster rate than if her mother had been just a real pussycat and a real cream puff to deal with. Elaine Durham had a seizure, Chicago, rushed to the hospital, had a cross. They called in a Catholic priest. They didn't know anything about her, but they called in a Catholic priest, give her last rite. She said he had a lot of spiritual power. She felt that power go through her. And then they took her to the morgue. Her body was in the morgue. She had a rather remarkable experience. She met Jesus. She made this little right turn and stepped out into a paradise-like place. There was a man there with a red beard waiting to talk to her. He said, Elaine, I'm here to show you around. He showed her a variety of things. Suddenly he said, turned to her and said, would you like to see yourself before you were born? She was thunderstruck by that. What? Before I was born? Yes. Sure. She was given a vision. She saw herself in front of a mirror-like thing. But it wasn't reflecting her. It was showing her the trajectories of her life. And she was making choices. So I'll take this, and then I'll take that, and I'll take this. She said there were five angels next to her. There were two senior angels and three training angels. And she said the training angels were getting upset, saying, no, no, it's too hard, it's too hard. And the two senior angels said, no, you step back. She wants the most she can out of the life she's choosing. And so she's taking some difficult choices. Her mother abandoned her. Her father molested her. One day she said to her father, you know, there were three men that could have been my father and it would have turned out the same. And she named the other two men. Her father said, how did you know that? How did you know that? No one knew that. No one knew that. And it turned out that the mother had been dating three men all at the same time and kind of trying to figure out which one she'd make a commitment to. And all three of them would have given her basically the same trials and difficulties and tribulations. Now, I'm a counselor. I'm a therapist by profession. Well, no, I'm not anymore. I don't send any of your friends to me. I'm old. I'm tired. I don't want to. In Joe versus the Volcano, the driver of the limousine that Joe hires to take him into New York City says, you're hinting around about clothes. You want to buy clothes. happens to be a particular subject of interest to me. Clothes make the man. I believe that. You want me to tell you what clothes to buy. You're asking me to tell you who you are. I don't want to tell you who you are. I'm old. I'm tired. I've had to work all my life to figure out who I am. I don't want to figure this out. Wait a minute, I'm coming back. And he stops the car and gets back in the back seat with Joe, and they have this wonderful conversation. Now, John Patrick Shanley had won an Oscar for making Moonstruck, so he could write his ticket in Hollywood, and he decided he would make Joe versus the Volcano. It was not a successful show. He went back to New York and has been a playwright the rest of his life. He's produced some amazing plays. He said he had seen whole neighborhoods in Brooklyn devastated because of heroin. Hollywood was worse than anything he'd seen in Brooklyn. The constant praise people give you if you're successful. He said he just couldn't. He said at least people in New York would be rude to him and he could. But he told someone that Joe versus the Volcano was based on a near-death experience that he had had. Now, there's only one way you know if an Irishman is lying, and that's if his mouth is moving. And so we don't know if John Patrick Shanley is just saying that to pull our chain, but there are a lot of themes in near, that are very closely related to the near-death experience in my favorite movie. One of the things I started out with is I thought, wow, you know, it'd be a real advantage to be able to talk to people who have had near-death visions of the future. The last thing I wanted to mention, then we can do a Q&A, or you can quietly sneak out. And the last thing I want to ask you is this. How many of you read a book called Visions of Glory by John Pontius? This is not in the book, but the individual that they call Spencer had a vision where he saw a destruction of Washington, D.C., and in his vision he saw pictures of all the presidents. Now, this was 20 years before Obama became the president, but he saw Obama as the last president. Now, that didn't work out, did it? So Spencer's vision is not coming to pass. Why not? I've tried to talk to the Spencer that dictated the book, and he and I have had a few conversations on the phone, but he's never come over and talked to me. He has spiritual insight, and he knows I'm nothing but a black hole. I don't know why he avoids me, but he does. Anyhow, I could tell him why his vision didn't come about. A man we've had out here three times, Howard Storm, said to his spiritual advisors, it took six or eight of them just to keep up with him. He was a very real scoundrel, and it took a lot of guardian angels to even keep him alive. He said, I've never noticed you in my life before. And they said, that's because you didn't want to notice. He said, show me the future. And they said, well, it could be this. And they show him some horrible Mad Max kind of future. Or it could be this, and that's a little less bad. And then it could be this, it's a little less bad. And they show him six or eight versions of the future, and they show him visions from each of the... And Howard is frustrated with him, and he says, don't show me what could be, show me what will be. The angels say, we cannot do that. If we tell you what will be, it will interfere with your freedom of choice. And we can never interfere with anyone's freedom of choice. Another term for that is agency. Big debate in psychology whether agency is real or if it's just a figment of our imagination. Well, I know that it's real. We get to choose, and our choices change everything. He sees all these horrible scenarios of the future, and he said, well, what can be done then to avoid this? And they said, love people. Well, no, I mean, there's got to be something I can do. Can I go back and build like a temple to the things I've seen here, a sculpture? He was a sculptor. He was a professor of art till he saw the error of his ways. He said, I can carve magnificent sculptures. They said, we're not interested in that. Just love people. He didn't want to go back to Earth. He said, okay, I get it. I want to be like you guys. I want to be like a guardian angel, and I'll help people out, and I'll get to be shiny like you are. I'll be able to shine from inside. They said, Howard, you haven't lived the kind of life that would let you do the work we do. we're going to send you back. He says, no, don't send me back. You don't know what it's like down there. Yeah, actually we do. And he said, don't send me back. He said, I didn't go to hell because I was an atheist. I went to hell. He said, I believe there'll be atheists in heaven. I went to hell because I was an angry, egotistical, self-centered atheist. And he said, I'll forget, I'll see, you know, everything is love, and then I'll forget to be loving, and then I'll hate myself, and I'll want to die, and I can't kill myself because now I see how precious that life is, and no, I don't send me back. And they said, no, we have to send you back. You know, you've got stuff you need to do. You've got things that you're supposed to do. Well, at least come to me and talk to me from time to time. And they said, look, we're not going to show up like this. Light, beings of just pure light, bursting with light. That would be more than you could handle if in the physical body. But we'll talk to you from time to time. Someone very close to him, he's praying about them when he gets back. And his prayer is, make them change. And the voice came into his mind and it said, now remember, he had been to hell. He said, Howard, we don't make people do things. That's not what we do. That's what the other guys do. Remember those guys? That's the wrong team you're praying to here, brother. He said, what can I do? And they said, love her. And he said, she's an alcoholic. She's not that easy to love. But they said, yeah, we already know that, Howard. I mean, this isn't a surprise to us. But we expect you to love her. How do we avoid some kind of Mad Max from Thunderdome scenario of the future or the Spencer visions of glory future, things like that? We do that by loving the people that are around us and showing some love for people that we run into and showing some love for people that irritate us to death. I learned that you have to practice forgiveness, and now I practice forgiveness. It pisses me off. I'm real angry that I have to forgive everything. But it turns out it's a better way than carrying this grudge, this catalog of wrongs and things like that. It's a far better way to live. I've tried it both ways. So I've learned a lot of things. I think studying near-death experiences has been a phenomenal experience for me. I was on TV one day and Rod Decker was interviewing me. And he turned to me and he said, you're a scientist. How do you explain these things? And I said, I've just got to take them at face value. And he stared at me for a half a second and disgust passed over his face. He turned away and started talking to somebody else. He didn't want to hear that idea that these things should be taken very, very seriously. But the fact that you came tonight shows that you want to take them seriously. Should we do a Q&A?
I noticed that throughout this discussion, you've mentioned some near-death experiences which included visions of premortal life, as it were.
At least three of them.
I just want to ask, I come from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who teaches this doctrine of premortality. Do you know of any other Christian church that teaches such a doctrine?
A lot of Christians believe it. People don't believe half the thing their churches teach anyway.
Does anybody actually preach this fundamental doctrine of their faith?
I just don't know. What I know is I've talked to a lot of people, Christians, and a lot of people believe, we have to come from somewhere. It's not uncommon. It's not terribly common, but it's one of the themes that comes up from time to time. The notion being, see, I've mentioned three people. If that's true, you have nothing to complain about. Oh, woe is me. My life is hard. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends drive all Porsches. I must make amends. Work hard all my life, Lord. No help from my friends. So, Lord, won't you buy me a And God says, no, you didn't choose that. That's not something you planned. I've got your life plan right here in front of me, and I just looked. You're going to drive a Kia. Oh, man. Don Wood said, if I had known how bad cystic fibrosis was, I'd have never chosen it.
I just want to know if you believe in a hell, then.
I have fairly good evidence that there's a hell. Jose Mesa is somebody here in Salt Lake who went to hell. He saw two of his friends there. One of them had overdosed and the other had been shot in a bad drug deal. Jose said, they were sort of like jumping up saying, "Hey, Jose, hey, you're here. Look, we're here too." He knew where he was. He said, "I had been in jail before. I knew how it felt. I was in a kind of jail." He gritted his teeth and he said, "Oh God, I did not want to die a sinner. Oh God, I did not want to die a sinner. Oh God, I did not want to die a sinner." You can pray when you're in hell. An immense light appeared. In the middle of the light was a figure, a being of some kind. Jose turned away, put his arm over his eyes, and the light came through the back of his head, and he could still see the person. He said, "His friends and all the people, they scattered like cockroaches." They skedaddled.
"Fred, I think Cain's going to be there because of what he did to his brother."
Maybe. I have no opinion about whether Cain's there. I don't think it's good for us to have opinions about things that we can't be sure of. We have no idea about who's there and who isn't. And we find from Jose's story, and we find Howard Storm's story, we find that hell is not a permanent place. He says, "I'm here because I lied. I'm here because I stole. I cheated. I'm here because I played with my life." Person in the light says, "Jose, don't play with your life anymore." He's in the back of the ambulance. He's got an endotracheal tube down him. He coughs it up, sits up, and the guy in the back jumped up and yelled, "Turn on the lights, he's alive!" And he's saying, "You taking me to jail? Did my mother rat me out?"
Why is it necessary to suffer to learn? Why can knowledge, experience, whatever, only... What is your opinion? What is your feeling?
That I have opinions. I mean, my opinions aren't any better than yours or anybody else's. Look,
a loving
I learned a lot from... I had both my knees replaced about 5 years ago. If you're going to have your knees replaced, do them both at the same time because it hurts so much. If you got one, you'd probably never do the other, you know, you say... No, I ain't going back there, huh? I've had a life with a fair amount of pain in it, physical pain.
Did you learn from it?
I learned you can do a lot of stuff whether you have pain or not. And that maybe if we do stuff when we're in pain, there's something valuable about it. There's something useful. I'm like a dog. I just go through life. Suddenly the lights are on, then they're off, and I look in my bowl, it's empty, and then I look in and there's food, you know. I don't understand much. Pain tells us what to quit doing. How many of you believe that adultery is a good idea? I'm still married to my first wife. It turns out that your life is a lot easier on you if you don't follow these adulterous notions that come into your brain. You think, my life works pretty well just the way it is. Thanks a lot. I believe I'll stay away from that. Does that make sense? So we can see other people's pain. We think, oh man, he really screwed his life up with that endeavor. And we can say, I want to stay a long way away from that. I had asthma one time and I was getting sick of my asthma. And I sat down in my chair and I visualized a change in the weather because we had one of these inversions. And every time I'd go out, I would just cough up pieces of lung and kidney and all kinds of things coming up. It was pretty bad stuff. And I sat down and I visualized as hard as I could a nice wind coming into the valley and blowing that out. And within 24 hours, the weather changed dramatically. Did I change it? I don't know. I've done that probably 3 or 4 dozen times. And the vast majority of the times, the thing that I visualize and imagine happens. Well, that's a pretty trivial and stupid talent, wouldn't you say? I can make it rain and wind blow. Can you make money appear under your pillow? No, I can't do that. I learned how to do that because I was in pain. And I later ended up healing my lungs and I don't have asthma anymore. And I could get temporary healing on my knees for 6 months or so if I prayed and visualized, okay, now, I want you to renew my body, make it like it was before. Then I had to wear a diaper. No, that's not true. but you can get a renewal of your body. You can do a lot of things. And yet, we live in a kind of a crappy world, you know. It turns out, Howard Storm said, is there life on other planets? And they said, well, let us show you. And they showed him these man-like creatures that looked pretty much like us, only they live on other planets. And then they showed him a bunch of really weird-looking creatures. And he said, they didn't explain it. I didn't know if they were cows on another planet or if they were intelligent beings. And he said, okay, I get it. There's life on other planets. Why don't we know about this? See, these angels keep giving Howard this bad news, right? He says, well, Howard, you live on like one of the worst planets ever, and it's full of violence and evil and wickedness. So you're under a quarantine. You're not allowed to know a lot of stuff. And so we're in a quarantined world. And Howard, being a college professor, he's quick as a whip. He says, wait a minute. If that's the case, why would anyone agree to be born on Earth? He realized he must have lived somewhere before he was born on Earth. They said, oh, well, that's because the people who agree to be born on Earth, where there's wickedness and violence and evil and selfishness, the people who agree to be born on Earth are God's favorites because they're willing to tackle the hardest assignment. So if you've had a crappy life, or if your knees have been bad, or if a partner stabbed you in the back and took all your money, or if you didn't get to marry the love of your life, or if you did get to marry your love of your life and then it turned out to be a bad choice, all of those things, that's all part of what we're here to do. We're learning, we're learning, we're learning.
So I just wanted to ask about like children and youth and their experiences or anything that you know. Like they're more attuned or they're...
Yeah, yeah. Melvin Morse has done a lot of that. You could look up his books. He's a pediatrician. He was an atheist Jewish pediatrician, and now he's a Christian. And he had to go through a lot of difficulty and trial coming to disbelieve his own atheism. The first gal that he ever interviewed, we have had her come down and give her story here. I've talked to maybe three people that went to hell. None of them were children, and they all sort of had it coming. You know what I mean? But on the other hand, there are people that would like to be good, and they do bad things, but their heart is in the right place, and they don't go to hell. They might not go to the front bench of heaven, but they might be on the path two-thirds of the way back, and they might be able to work their way up or something.
And so the dark place that they were sent, is it a physical place or is it just a feeling?
The dark place appears to be a neighborhood. I'm saying it appears to be a neighborhood. Look, when Jose arrives in hell, a couple of his old friends are there. It's a neighborhood. See? And there are better neighborhoods. One of my patients tried to commit suicide, and she said there were some dark people trying to get her to go down the dark way, and then there was a person of light trying to get her to go the other way, and she went with that person and met Jesus, and he said, didn't you read my book? There's a book, you can read it. Read the book. Anyway, there's neighborhood. They're in different directions.
First of all, I really appreciate the way that you are presenting things in a very, just saying this is my opinion and not trying to preach or anything. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Also,
that's because I'm not smart enough to know what's true. I just, all I can do is remember what I've been told.
It's nice to stay open.
Yeah.
So, also, I don't believe it has to be where you have to die to be able to have visions and things like that. I've had visions that have helped me in my life that are profound and life-changing, and I didn't have to die to experience
that. I think that's true. I have the spiritual experiences of a beagle. You know, I mean, I was talking to one of my patients one day, and I wanted to make this point, and I said, all right, what do we know for sure about God? She's a very spiritual woman. She said, that he loves us. And I said, I am told by authorities I trust that that is the case. I have no direct knowledge of that. She said, oh, you poor thing. I said, yeah, it's rough being me, I'll tell you. It's awful. I said, but you know that. I assume it and I hear that. That's a faith-promoting rumor and I believe it. What we know for sure about God is he's nuts about variety. He's nuts about diversity. He loves diversity. He loves tall people, short people, fat people, skinny people, black people, brown people, yellow people, white people. He loves smart people. He loves dumb people because he made all those people. I finally figured out an answer to your question. It takes me 30 minutes. Howard Storm says, why is there so much pain on the earth? And they showed him a vision. And it was a vision of a forest. And it was a vision of a mountain. And there was a tree out on the edge of the precipice. And the winds are blasted and twisted around. There's another stout tree growing up in the middle of the forest. And there are small trees and there are tall trees. And then they show him a tree farm. And every tree is exactly equal. And they said, and they didn't say, you're an artist. But they said, look, which is more beautiful? We'll drive a long way to see variety. Nobody drives to see tree farms. So we come here, and this is a wild and crazy place we live in. And that's what makes it beautiful.
In your experience with interviewing these people that have had the choice to come back, but not told why they were coming back, what approach have these people used to figure out what it is that they were supposed to be doing when they came back?
That's a really good question. Our neighbor told us that there was a Rottweiler that was going to go to the pound. Broke my heart. It's a 100-pound dog. Nobody will adopt that Rottweiler, and she'll go to her death. And our dog had died, and I said, do not do that. Give her to us. So we adopted a Rottweiler. Turns out she's a great guard dog for the little kids, you know. I mean, she would watch them like a hawk. I took her for a run after we got her. She's a six-month-old dog. And we're running down the road, and there's a field with cows in it. And she could look at the cows. And we'd run along. She was looking at those cows. And we turned the corner. She kept looking back at the cows. I went home, and I looked up Rottweiler in the encyclopedia. Now, an encyclopedia was a bunch of books, and they went from A to Z. And you could get the R down and look up Rottweiler. And it turns out that the Rottweiler is bred. It's one of the more ancient breeds. It was bred by the Romans to herd cattle. Those cattle were speaking to her. There's something about us that's important. And she was saying, yeah, there's something important there. I don't know quite what it is. As you go through your life, things strike you as this is important. We're all just dogs. We're all Rottweilers. We love to be with each other. The best gift you can give your dog is another dog. We are group animals. But each of us has something that we're supposed to be about, and as we go through our life, something will speak to us. Now, if we're drunk, if we're high on drugs, if we're living a selfish life, if we're being crooked and faithless, and then we don't hear it because it's not a loud voice, see? It's a very quiet kind of thing, but you've heard it. My granddaughter Lily and I, last year, we appeared in the Draper City talent show. She's seven. She sang, "Give Me Oil in My Lamp," and I was in the background playing the guitar. And then when she'd forget a verse, I'd start her out. So it's a cute little thing. And I think this year we're going to do that Kermit the Frog song, "Why Are There So Many Songs About Rainbows? What's on the Other Side?" Now, in the third verse it says, "Have you been half asleep? And have you heard voices? I've heard them calling my name. Are these the sweet sounds that call to young sailors? The voice could be one and the same. I've heard it too many times to ignore it. It's something I'm supposed to be." Then you go to the coda. Someday we'll find it, the Rainbow Connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. So Lily and I are going to work that song up. And if they do another talent show, we'll sing that. Put it on YouTube or something, on all her, the aunts and uncles and grandparents can go and watch her. There's something that will speak to you if you're on the right path and you're not engaged in a lot of selfishness and cruelty. Then things speak to you and it says you're supposed to be here. You're supposed to be doing this. We run past the cattle and we start looking at them because they speak to us. Oh man, that was my best line. One more question.
Let me tell you this.
I thought I was done. How do I top that? I'm in real bad shape here.
You've been absolutely delightful. You know, I thought we were going to talk to somebody that got murdered tonight, but unfortunately.
She had to go to the hospital last night, but it's not her husband. He's in prison, so it's just things happen, stuff happens, and you never know what's coming down the road.
I just wanted to ask you, do you think that God has a sense of humor?
We had a nurse speak to us once that said there was a little boy in the burn unit, and he is in a coma, and he wakes up, and the family clusters around. Okay, Jimmy, you're going to get better, you're going to get better. And he very brightly says, no, I'm going to die. Oh, don't say that. No, I said, I've been to Heavenly Father. I sat on his lap, and he told me I'm going to die, and he'd sent me back to say goodbye to you. He told me 3 jokes. Would you like to hear them? I asked her, what were the jokes? She said, the family said they're like jokes from God, and they don't want anybody else to hear them. I said, okay, that makes sense. So I don't know what the jokes were. There was a woman that was written about, I think it was in one of Ken Ring's books. She had 3 near-death experiences, and each time she was told to stay, and she said, no, I've got to go back and take care of my children. No, I've got to do this. There are things left undone. And the last time Jesus said to her, all right, now look, you've done what I sent you to do. It's time for you to come home. And she said, no, I haven't danced enough yet. And Jesus started laughing. Now, I think it's hard to get Jesus to laugh, because when you tell him a joke, he already knows the punchline, you know. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's a good one. I like humor. I like it a lot. I really appreciate humor. I had a woman that actually gave her near-death experience here, and she said she came out to talk to me before we had her speak at the group, and she said she was coming out, and she was saying to God, tell me about this guy. God said, he makes me laugh. I thought, wow, that's a good achievement. But you laugh, you know, when your granddaughter tells that knock-knock joke, you laugh, you know, because it's a way of showing delight. So suppose, pretend, imagine that God's experience of us is one of delight, that you're actually delightful just the way you are. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Good night.